Today's Teisho will be on case 40 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 40 is entitled Nonsense This Flower. Engo's introduction. When the action of the mind is stopped and swept away, the iron tree will bloom. Can you demonstrate it? Even a crafty fellow will come a cropper here. Even if he excels in every way, he will have his nostrils pierced. What are the complications? See the following. Main subject, Riku Taifu, while talking with Nansen, said, Joe Hoshi said, Heaven and earth and I are of the same root. All things and I are of one substance. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? Nansen pointed to a flower in the garden, called Taifu to him, and said, People these days see this flower as though they were in a dream. Secho's verse, Hearing, seeing, touching, and knowing are not one and one. Mountains and rivers should not be viewed in the mirror. The frosty sky, the setting moon at midnight. With whom will the serene waters of the lake reflect the shadows in the cold? I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. We had there was some very deep sitting here this morning. People sat very still, and then we all got up and we had a little break and we went out and listened to the drum music. Normally it's very quiet out there, and last time we did it, it was quite still, and you could hear the wind blow. This time, drum practice, and I guess they use the campus for groups in the summer, and they have sort of like a music camp for high school bands. The wind is beautiful, and if you don't make any distinctions, the sound of the drumming is also quite thrilling. You know, if you went out there remembering our last outing a couple weeks ago, you might have been ready for the stillness and the peace, and then these drums could be, quite an intrusion. But on the other hand, in Zen temples, when they just before they have a Dharma talk or a Teisho like this one, they have a big drum, and they beat the drum relentlessly, and the drummer also has uses the drumsticks on the nail heads that hold the drum head on. And so there's this boom, 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 very loud. And it's actually quite thrilling. It's like listening to thunder. So today we were listening to thunder. If we have no distinctions, then it can be quite exciting. Today's Teisho is on a conversation between a monk named Rika Taifu and a great Zen master named Nansen. And Rika Taifu says to Nansen, said, I heard another great Zen master say this, Heaven and I are of the same root. All things and I are of one substance. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? Nansen pointed to a flower in the garden, called Taifu to him, and said, People these days see this flower as though they were in a dream. So, basically, this monk says to Nansen, I have heard this great Zen teacher say that everything is one. It's all one. It's all one. Isn't that wonderful? And then Nansen gives a response which is a little bit odd. He doesn't say, yes, it's all one. He was so right. He doesn't say it's not all one. He says something that doesn't quite fit. He says, he pointed to a flower in the garden, called Taifu to him and said, people these days see this flower as though they are in a dream. So, you know, like most koans, this koan points to something that we normally overlook in the moment. And it does this by creating a kind of puzzle or a kind of a contradiction that we might try to figure out with our intellectual minds, our discriminating minds, but which really asks us to sit on the cushion and explore the moment in a different way. So please don't try to figure this koan out. This is an opportunity to notice something about the moment which you might have overlooked. So as a way of sort of giving some pointers, I'd like to step away from the koans for a moment and talk about a great Zen teacher who just died, Charlotte Joko Beck. Some of you might have followed her life and her recent death. She died at 94. She was a student of Maizumi Roshi many years ago. She was in her 40s when she started practicing Zen. She had a background in music. She went to she actually was from New Jersey. She went to New England at a conservatory and studied music and music theory. She got married and she had three kids and she moved to California. Her marriage fell apart and she raised the children by herself. And when she was in her 40s, she became very interested in Zen and started practicing with Maizumi Roshi, who was the founder of the Los Angeles Zen Center. And she practiced with Maizumi for many years. When she was in her 60s, she received authorization to teach and started teaching. And she taught for about 20 years in San Diego. She started the San Diego Zen Center. And retired in her 80s and lived to be 94. While she was training with Maizumi, she worked as a secretary and worked her way up in the UC San Diego system to be department administrator. So she did that for like 20 years while she was training with Maizumi. And you know, long before her books came out, when I was training at the Seattle Zen Center, I had some friends who were training at ZCLA. And they would talk to me about this woman, Charlotte Beck, who was apparently quite a remarkable person. So already she had some kind of reputation for being an extraordinary practitioner. I was reading something the other day about how she was living in San Diego and working at UC San Diego. And she would drive up to LA, which is about a 2-hour drive, every week to sit with Maizumi Roshi. So she'd drive 2 hours up and 2 hours back. She did that week after week. And I was reading a recollection of her by a guy who's a Zen teacher, Gary Wick. And he just talked about how he remembers meeting her after a sesshin. And that he also was working at UC San Diego. At that time, he was an oceanographer. And they were both students of Maizumi, and he met her after a sesshin, and she just couldn't stop laughing. She was so happy. I think Joko Beck is probably one of the most important Zen teachers in the last 20 years. There was this first generation of teachers who brought Zen to America. So Maizumi was in that group. Also, Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. Also, Edo Roshi in New York. And there were a number of other teachers. There was a teacher in Minnesota. There were several other teachers from Japan who came and started Zen centers and began to attract lots of students. And these students were really excited and sort of starry-eyed about Zen. I myself was one of those students. I was really thrilled. I had read books on Zen practice. And I had read Alan Watts, who's really quite a good writer, and his books are really very interesting. And I had read D.T. Suzuki. And I always thought maybe that someday I would go to Japan. But when I was in Seattle, a Japanese Zen master came to Seattle and started a Zen center, Genki Roshi. So I didn't have to go to Japan. Japan came to me. It was really amazing. And I remember that when Genki started the Seattle Zen Center, we would get 40 people in the evening to sit. It would just be, the room would be packed. People were so excited about Zen and about practice. And there was really something in the air. It was just part of the time, the spirit of the time. People were really quite interested in exploring consciousness, you know, consciousness. When I had gone to college, I remember my roommate came to see me one day. His name was Tom Singer. We were all, everybody on my hall had a name that began with S. So all the S's were on this hall in the dorm. And so I was roomie with Tom Singer. And Tom Singer came in, and he pulled this book out of his briefcase as though it were like a secret. He looked at me and he said, "Have you seen this book?" And he handed it to me like, "You won't believe it," right? And I looked, and it was called The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaki Way of Knowledge. And I looked at this book and I thought, Don Juan, isn't he a great lover in, you know, European? But then, it's not that Don Juan. It's a great Yaki Indian sorcerer. And I read the book. I couldn't put it down. It was about an anthropologist who goes to investigate Mexican Indians and their shamanistic practices. And he actually is looking, he meets this man at a bus stop, you know, who turns out to be a great shaman. And the shaman, whose name is Don Juan, introduces the anthropologist, Carlos Castaneda, to an alternative universe. It's real as our universe. And he introduces Castaneda to this universe by having him use different kinds of psychotropic drugs. So this was like perfect for the 60s. You know? This was like... And many people were experimenting with drugs, and there was this interest in, you know, changing consciousness, that you know, the world we live in is artificial in certain ways, and that we can experience alternative realities, you know. So I remember actually reading this book and not being able to put it down. And actually, when I graduated from college, I went down to Mexico looking for a Yaqui shaman myself. And I didn't find one. I had a nice time. I went to the beach, and I guess I didn't look very hard. But I didn't find any shamans at the bus stop, bus station. However, you know, like so many people of that generation, I was really excited by the thought that reality was not fixed. You know, that we can change not just our attitudes, but that the way we see things is artificial, and that we can really explore reality in a richer way. That was really exciting to me. And so when I met Genki Roshi, this was like meeting Don Juan at the bus station, you know. He was a mysterious little guy, you know. He was very nice, but he, I didn't really know what made him tick. He seemed extremely kind, and I thought maybe he could do anything, you know. I had no idea. Maybe he was going to show me, like Don Juan, how to fly through the air or jump off of cliffs and not be hurt. I didn't really know, but I was very excited. And so were those other 39 people who came to see Genki Roshi every Wednesday night to do Zazen. Zen helped me a great deal. I didn't really understand why, but it helped me a lot. Along the way, like many people, I had a lot of interesting experiences, you know. So I can remember the first time I went into deep samadhi. I was meditating on a cushion, and I suddenly realized that almost my whole body felt like it had disappeared. And all I could feel was just a little piece of my face and a little bit of my hands, and it was like my body had completely disappeared. And I sort of felt like I was floating like cobwebs in the air. And that was really an interesting experience. The first time that ever happened to me, I was impressed. I thought, that's very interesting, you know. My whole way of experiencing the body is different. And it was a very cool feeling, you know, to just be weightless and insubstantial. Later, after a session, I talked to somebody else, and he said that he had had a similar experience, you know, that when you go into deep samadhi, sometimes you experience your body in very different ways. You know, one person had this experience where she felt like she was expanding and expanding and expanding. And another person felt, glowing sort of energy and so on and so on. And these were interesting experiences. You know, over the years, over my years of Zen practice, I actually had many unusual experiences. I can remember the first time I experienced mu, you know, emptiness. I was staying at my father's house in Virginia. I had to go to Virginia and take care of my father's house. And it was like freezing cold. My father didn't want me to turn the heat up because he was a cheapskate and he wanted to save money on. So he said, there's a heater in the kitchen. You can stay in the kitchen and you can be warm in there, but the rest of the house should be, you know, keep it at, I don't know, 62 or something like that. So anyway, I remember staying at the house for a week and being habitually cold and uncomfortable. And I had already started sitting with Genki Roshi. I decided to do some zazen, not in the kitchen, but in one of the rooms in the house. I was all by myself. And I sat down and I started doing zazen, and it was the most extraordinary thing, because I actually felt like absolutely everything in the world disappeared. It was just like everything. It was just like I had fallen into a giant black hole. It was just emptiness. And when it was over, I was impressed. And I thought, what was that? And I didn't go into, I didn't tell my teacher, Genki Roshi. Only years later did I realize that was my first experience of mu. You know, absolute emptiness, time disappeared. I don't know how long I was sitting. And I've had other, I could go on and on. I could tell you about many interesting experiences of altered consciousness, you know. A number of years ago, we were having sesshin, when we used to have sesshin at my house, we would just have a small group of about between, say, 6 and 10 people doing sesshin at my house. Yen was always there, Jaru, Imtiaz, Jim, some of you know Jim. Everybody, we finished a sesshin at my house, and I said goodbye to everybody. And then I was sitting, it was still light because it was summer, and I heard this sound that was the most extraordinary sound. I just couldn't place it. And I listened, and it was so beautiful. It was just like, I can't describe it. It was indescribably beautiful. And it would come like in a wave, and then it would go away. And then it would come in a wave, and it would go away. And I just thought, that is so beautiful. What could that be? And I went around the corner. It was a sprinkler going, shh. But in my altered state of consciousness, you know, this was so beautiful. Now, I can remember many years earlier than that, leaving a sesshin at the Seattle Zen Center. And my friends went into like a quick check. And I sat in the car and I turned on the radio. And there was just some music on the radio, like bubblegum music. You know, it was just very... But it was so, I thought, oh my God, that's breathtakingly beautiful. So, you know, I can, I remember once we used to have sesshin at our temple, Tokuganji, which was up in the mountains north of Clay Ellum, which is in central Washington. And at that time, we had not completed the temple complex, and we used to have Dokusan in the kitchen. So we'd leave the Zendo and we'd go sit on the wood chips on the path to the kitchen, and we would wait to go into Dokusan in a line. And I remember sitting there and just watching the snow build up on the shoulders of the person in front of me. And I was so cold. It was so cold. And I remember the first time I just had no experience of cold. It was the most amazing experience. It was like suddenly the cold was gone, and I knew it was like 15 degrees out. But I just felt absolutely wonderful. And it was an amazing experience, you know. So, you know, all of these kinds of experiences of altered consciousness are quite remarkable, interesting, and they were sort of what I signed up for when I started doing Zen. I was very interested in this issue of altered consciousness. And so were many, many people of my generation. They were really fascinated by the possibility that, you know, there isn't just ordinary consciousness, there's many different kinds of consciousness, and that the world appears to be very different in certain states of mind, and that this could be really liberating. You know, this could be really liberating. This was the generation that received Zen from Japan. People who had this kind of an outlook, Charlotte Joko Beck was part of that generation. But she began to notice something that was interesting, and it really changed her. And when she became a teacher at age I guess in her 60s, she decided to teach in a very different way. She noticed that a lot of the people who were having these remarkable, amazing experiences weren't necessarily becoming mentally healthy people. Isn't that interesting? She noticed that some people who would go to Sesshin and have these amazing experiences would come back and be angry, easily angered, fearful, nervous people. You know, she could see this. And maybe she saw it in herself. She went to these sesshins where she had these amazing experiences. And then, you know, maybe back on the job, she might have found herself stressed, angry, fearful. And there was a kind of disconnect, you know, between what was happening to her in these sesshins and on the cushion and her life, you know. And she also noticed that her own teacher, Maizumi Roshi, had certain problems. You know, if you investigate the history of the Los Angeles Zen Center, it's kind of an interesting history because, first of all, Maizumi Roshi was a brilliant Zen teacher. I never met him, but he is easily the best Zen teacher in the United States of his generation. He produced many, he had the ability to inspire and nurture many people with great abilities. So, for example, Daido Lori was his student. Chosen Bais was his student. Bernie Glassman was his student. You know, he was able to inspire and support, sustain and nourish people with very different personalities and very different abilities. He was a genius, really, as a Zen teacher. On the other hand, he had some problems of his own that he never managed to resolve. So, for example, he had an alcohol problem. He was actually an alcoholic. And, you know, at one point he actually joined a 12-step program because he couldn't get his alcoholism under control. So this was a whole generation of people went through this process of being very excited about Zen and being tremendously interested and very very surprised by all the doors it could open. And then on the other hand, they also began to notice that certain kinds of problems weren't getting solved, you know. Even a great Zen genius like Maizumi Roshi had not sort of worked through some of his own inner conflicts, you know. And basically he could enter these alternate states of consciousness. He knew the mind inside and out. He had experienced selflessness, oneness, etc., etc., in very powerful ways. And yet, you know, when he was off the cushion, when he was in his daily life, he must have had some kind of unresolved issues that produced his drinking problem, you know. And so, Joko Beck was a really revolutionary Zen teacher because she, instead of concentrating so much on the remarkable experiences you can have in Zen, and these experiences of oneness and connectedness and so on, she began to teach in a way that would get her students to look at their fears, their projections, their anger, their I'm sure you understand what I mean. She got people to look at the things that were troubling them. So a lot of the time when she did Dokusan with people, she would it would almost turn into like therapy, like a therapy session or psychoanalysis. She wanted people to face their fears, to face their anger, their disappointment, their false expectations. And it was actually a wonderful thing. It really was a very good thing for the whole Zen community to take this turn, you know. If you read her books, they're actually quite interesting because they're really all about working through our inner obstacles, working through our projections, our fantasies. And she was very interested in the ways in which life can disappoint us, you know, disappoint us. And she said, you know, actually life is like a series of disappointments. You know, so we think you get married and you think, oh, every day of my life is going to be a happy day now that I'm married, right? And of course, if you're involved in a marriage, you know it's stressful in many ways. It's very difficult and challenging. And it really never quite works out the way you planned, right? Your relationships are dynamic, unpredictable. People are discovering things about themselves. They bring to the relationship a lot of baggage. And so, you know, Beck was a teacher who was... What Beck did was to ask people to confront these things, you know. So Zen was not so much about meeting Don Juan at the bus station and experiencing alternate realities. It became something of like therapy, you know, confronting your obstacles, confronting your fears. And this, I think this is very, very important, really very important. It's become quite, her approach is really quite popular now. If you look at the Zen world, so many teachers in Zen, in the Zen world, are therapists. In fact, I know so many Zen teachers, and almost all of them went back to school and got degrees in clinical psychology or psychology. Many of them are practicing psychotherapists or counselors. And they've really combined Zen with therapy in very fruitful ways, and I think this is quite good. I think this is really a good idea. You know, our culture is not particularly healthy, I think, psychologically. I was just reading about a number of people who are who suffer from emotional disorders. It seems to be going up and up and up. I was talking to Sharon before the sit on Wednesday, and she was working on a hotline. And she said that she gets a lot of calls from people who are thinking of committing suicide. And I have read things about this, that there's very high rates of, you know, the number of people, because of economic distress and insecurity and other problems, there's a lot of psychological distress. And also, I think people don't necessarily grow up in such a healthy way. You know, I have met people from the Tibetan tradition, and I'm always impressed. You know, some of these Tibetan monks grew up in like these little villages, you know, and they seemed, maybe I'm fantasizing, but they often seem like very balanced people. You know, very balanced people. And I think it's because they come, you know, those little villages were sort of perhaps, I think, you know, like healthier societies. I remember reading that the Dalai Lama was meeting with a bunch of American teachers, American meditation teachers. And they were talking about the problem of what they called self-loathing. And the Dalai Lama didn't understand what self-loathing was. And I don't think it was just because he's the Dalai Lama. It was because I think maybe in his culture, that's just not a problem, you know. So you know, we have perhaps, we have a culture that has gone through like very rapid change. We don't have strong communities. People are very isolated. And even families are fall apart, or there's a lot of dysfunction. So I think that what Charlotte Beck did was really great, very important. You know, we really need to be aware of our small self and its fears and its obstacles, its projections and its disappointments. You know, it's possible to go into Zen as a way of escaping these problems. You know, you can get into Zen, and Zen can become like a way of not dealing with your personal problems. You know, and I think Charlotte Beck, Joko Beck, saw that lots of people were practicing Zen, entering these states of like ecstasy, and meanwhile they hadn't worked through, you know, their own personal issues. You know, they were really sort of avoiding looking at their own insecurities, fears, obstacles, and so on. And so she really has changed the face of Zen by making it very much like therapy. I think this is really important, and I think it's very necessary. But on the other hand, you know, I think it's very important to remember that that's not all there is to liberation, you know? I was rereading one of Joko Beck's books the other day, and I thought, you know, this is all very wise and very true, but there's more to Zen than this, you know? There's more to Zen than this. This is very important, and it is crucial, right? Crucial. A lot of Zen has to be about confronting our unhappiness, our insecurities, and so on. It's very important. But I also think it's very important not to lose sight of this other thing, you know, this other element of practice, which is that, you know, consciousness really is very... You know, we get stuck in these mindsets that are very narrow and unsatisfying, even if we're psychologically healthy, you know. Ordinary consciousness is somewhat limiting, you know. You can be a psychologically healthy person, and you can still find life in the modern world to be... a little bit impoverished, you know, people become psychologically unhealthy because I think the reality we have created as a society is unhealthy, you know. So I worry that Joko Beck maybe went just a little too far, you know, in emphasizing, you know, disappointment, you know. It's important to have your feet on the ground. You know, if you can use Zen or any practice like Zen to sort of like be escaping from reality or escaping from your emotional issues. You know, so you sit on the cushion, you enter an ecstatic state, and you're not dealing with the fact that you have a bad relationship with your kids. Let's say, you know. So she's got a point. But on the other hand, I think that these altered states are really very valuable too. You know, very valuable too. There is something important about that insight that people had, that, you know, 50 years ago or 40 years ago, that consciousness is, you know, bigger than we think. Bigger than we think. You know, when you do Zen, if you go to, say, a sesshin, you do Zen for, say, 9 hours a day for 5 to 7 days, you know, so many things change in a way that I think is really positive and really liberating. You know, around day 3 of a sesshin, you begin to experience almost everything in a different way. You know, the small self, the personal self, becomes much less important. And consciousness is much more fully and completely in the present moment, in the flow of moments from moment to moment. And there's usually this tremendous sense of relief, this tremendous sense of excitement, and most of all, like this very powerful sense of connection, of oneness. And I think this is very important, you know, knowing that the way we ordinarily experience the world is not quote unquote real. In some ways, it's very unreal. It's very unreal. You know, ordinary consciousness can be very unreal. You know, so often, you know, you get up in the morning, and you get up in the morning. It's 5:30. You've got to get to your job. You have a cup of coffee. You're listening to the radio. You have to drive to work. You get to work. You know, there's stuff on your desk. You start moving. You know, start moving the paper, or you have to. And whatever your job might be, maybe you're in the health professions, you get on the job and you've immediately got to take care of somebody who's ill or something, or, it's pressure. And, you're basically just trying to stay on top of things. And then it's 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock and you get home, you have your meal, maybe you turn on the TV and you unwind, and you go to bed. Next day, same thing. That's a way of living. You know, it has a lot of dignity. You know, maybe you are doing something that's really worthwhile. You're helping others. Maybe you enjoy your work. It has an existential meaning to you. You know, that's wonderful. But you might still feel, even if you're psychologically quite healthy and you're happy with your work, at some point you might think, gee, is this all there is to life? You know, is this all there is? And I think Zen can really open up something extraordinary. You know, you go to the Sesshin, and by around day 3, you realize, oh my gosh, you know, reality is so much bigger than I thought it was, you know? And it's one thing to read about it. It's another thing to really experience it, you know? By day 3, you're in the flow of moments, and the small, what we call the small self, that constant fretting about me, is sort of gone, and there's just this unfolding of moment to moment to moment, and it can actually be thrilling, and you feel so alive. One feels so alive. It's so remarkable. And you go to lunch and you look down at a bowl of rice, and it's just so beautiful, and you're not thinking even rice. You're just staring at the rice, and you're sort of like one with the rice. And you eat the rice, and it's like the most delicious meal you've ever had. And then you finish the meal, and we go back into the zendo, and you hear a bird sing. And it's just, it's as though there's no film between you and the sound of the bird. There's no distance. It's just your mind becomes all sound, you know. And it's just the most wonderful thing. And people can stay in that condition for days, you know. Then they go home, and it's back to the job. But people are changed by those experiences in, I think, a really positive way. You know, knowing that the world is bigger, having experienced the world in this more open, connected way, I think has an effect. You know, opening the world up in this way, I think, makes people more hopeful. I think it makes them more creative, and I think it makes them more compassionate. You know, knowing that the world really is a big place. You know, one way to think about Zen practice is that it's like opening up. It's like you're drawing a circle around yourself over and over again. You know, that's sort of like what we do in life. Our reality is 1 foot out, you know, and every day it's 1 foot out, 1 foot out. 1 foot away from us, there's a circle, right? And that's sort of like reality. Every day we go back into that circle. And I think what Zen practice can do is, you know, it draws the circle a little bigger, like 2 feet out, you know? You go to a sesshin and you realize, oh, it's not really that narrow. It's a little bigger, you know? And then you go to you keep practicing Zen for 10 years and it's like 3 feet out or 4 feet out. And I think imperceptibly, little by little, the world gets to be bigger, gets to be a bigger place. And the kind of claustrophobia you feel ordinarily goes away. You know, it's like you realize the world is kind of an amazing place. It is kind of a mysterious place, you know? It is kind of an astonishing place to be. And I think people get that experience in other ways too, you know? You listen to music and you think, oh my God, that is so beautiful. I like the composer John Adams. And I was listening to his music the other day and I just thought, that is breathtaking. You know, the world got a little bigger for me. You know, the circle got a little bigger. And sometimes you go and if you like art, you go to a museum. About a year ago, they had a show on abstract expressionists, the New York expressionists, whom I love. And I went to this show and I just was walking on air. You know, it's like, it opened my world up, you know. You know, somebody could say, well, you like art, but you're still not dealing with your bullshit. You know, you're still not dealing with your inner conflicts. And it's like, okay, that's true. But I like art, you know what I mean? I'll deal with those too, right? You know, so it's not either or, right? It's not either or. I mean, I think Joko Beck did a good thing. She said, look, you have to deal with your bullshit. You have to deal with your inner conflicts. You can't just sit on the cushion and have these big experiences of big mind and forget about the fact that you have these other issues. And she's right. You know, you have to clean up your house, your inner house, you know. But on the other hand, there's more to life than that. You know, it's like going to the concert and hearing music, you know. And maybe I haven't worked through all my issues, but that experience is like giving me entry into a bigger world. You know, my world has just gotten a little bigger hearing this music. And you go to the painting, you see the gallery show, and you think, oh my God, I've never seen anything like that before. That's so interesting. You know, maybe you wake up, sometimes I see paintings and I wake up at night and I'm thinking about the painting. I like painting that much, you know. And maybe you are a computer engineer, you know, and you design software or something and you get up in the middle of the night and you're just totally jazzed about this, you know. Or maybe you're a scientist and you're doing something, some kind of research and it's, you know, it makes you feel more alive. You know, somebody can say, well, you're not dealing with your bullshit. All you care about is science. It's like, there are many scientists who are quite screwed up, I'm sure. And there are many painters who are extremely screwed up. You know? And there are many writers who are beyond screwed up. Nevertheless, you know, those things are essential to life. And I think they all do the same thing as meditation. They all make the circle bigger. Make the circle bigger. And that's, you know, that's very important. You know, cleaning up your house is important, you know. So cleaning up your life is important. Working through your inner contradictions, therapy is really excellent, you know. I think it's like cleaning up your house. You're getting the house ready for the guests to arrive. But once the house is cleaned up, the guest has to come, see? I think Joko Beck did a good thing, but I'm wondering if she forgot about the guest. You know what I mean? So she said, look, you're bringing the guest over, but your house is a mess. You know, all you do is bring the guest over, but the place is a pigsty, you know? The doors don't open, the windows are nailed shut, you know, the water is leaking on the floor. Okay, true enough. And she did a great service because You know, somebody like Maizumi was like somebody who was a wonderful host whose house was falling apart. Really. On the other hand, once the house is tidy and neat, once it's clean and everything's in order, you can sit there and twiddle your thumbs, you know. But what about the guest? So Zen is about both of these things, cleaning up the house and welcoming the guest. You know, when you sit on the cushion and you realize, oh my gosh, you know, I have to deal with so-and-so at work. Oh, crap. I hate that guy, right? Then you realize, okay, you know, why am I so afraid of this person? Oh, I remember. I used to get beaten up in Baltimore at the playground, you know, which is true. That did happen to me. So I'm reliving my fantasies of revenge against these kids who used to beat me up, and I'm maybe projecting on this guy. No, he has hurt my feelings, etc., you know. So you work through that stuff, and you have to work through it. It's very important. But then at some point, you know, you're watching the breath, and you suddenly feel the moment just come and go. And you feel like the doors have opened up, and that claustrophobia goes away. And you walk outside, and everything seems so alive. See, that's worth a lot. So we have to clean up the house, but don't forget the guest. And it's true. You know, a lot of people of my generation didn't clean up the house. But, you know, once you get the house cleaned up, the work is, the most important thing is the coming of the guest. Right? Okay. Engo's introduction says, when the action of the mind is stopped and swept away, the iron tree will bloom. See? So, normally we're thinking. And when we do this, you know, things become very opaque and distant. And you can be so caught up in your thoughts that somebody could be talking to you and you suddenly go, huh? What did you say? This is typical, right? I mean, we can be so caught up in ourselves or in thinking that we don't really, we're not really in the moment. And so Engo is saying, look, when you're really in the moment, you know, you have that moment at Sesshin where suddenly you're not thinking anymore and you hear a bird and it's just 100% bird. You know, it's just sound. You're just with it. You're eating your rice and it's the most delicious rice in the world, right? That's when the iron tree will bloom. See, the iron tree, it's like, oh my God, I feel so alive. I feel so connected. Everything, you know, I thought rice was just rice, but it's actually alive, you know. I thought grass was just grass, but it's actually intensely alive. And I think that Zen practice sometimes gives us that, you know. You sometimes have that feeling that things are just intensely alive. Main subject. Rika Taifu, while talking with Nansen, said, Joe Hoshi said, heaven and earth and I are the same root. All things are of one substance. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? So it's all one, see? And Nansen says, really what he says is, if you say it's all one, it's still not one. See? When it's really one, you don't say that. You're just in the one. You're with the one. So that's still a kind of intellectual judgment. You know, the ideal state is to just be fully present in the moment, without projections, without expectations, and with the empty mind as things unfold. And in that state, you don't go, gee, it's all one. It's just bird. It's just rice. It's just dinner. You know, it's just smell. So anyway, cleaning up the house is important. And I think Joko Beck, I wish I had read Joko Beck 30 years ago instead of, you know, more recently than that. Because I too realize I didn't clean up my house enough, you know. On the other hand, cleaning up the house is not enough. Welcoming the guest is what life is all about. You know, there's that wonderful book. It says, After Enlightenment, the Laundry. Right? I love that book. But I think there should be a sequel called After the Laundry, Enlightenment. See? Because I think you need both. Right? I mean, I'm not sure. I think you need both. Laundry, Enlightenment. Laundry, Enlightenment. Those are both essential. Secho's verse, hearing, seeing, touching, and knowing are not one and one. Mountains and rivers should not be viewed in the mirror, right? Direct. The frosty sky, the setting moon at midnight, with whom will the serene waters of the lake reflect the shadows in the cold? So, you know, those moments when the boundary between ourselves and the world fall away are quite important. You know, Zen would say they're very important. You know, all of Buddhist culture is about experiencing our deepest connection to everything. Even, by the way, being one even with our failings, being one even with our flaws, being one even with our inadequacies. You know, that's really important. So anyway, I hope you had a good sit. I hope you continue to practice. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.